Good afternoon. This is Carol Moyle, Committee Assistant, Environment and Energy Committee. Today is Monday, June 20th, 1 p.m., Hearing Room E. Agenda for today includes a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 237B relating to exclusive farm use zones and marginal lands, and Senate Bill 360 relating to land use.
Meeting of Environment and Energy will come to order. Clerk, if you will please take note of those here. Those not here are excused. First order of business today is to deal with Senate Bill 360.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bradbury.
I would move that we lift Senate Bill 360 from the table.
Representative Bradbury moves that we take Senate Bill 360 from the table. Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Carol is passing out the amendments to 360. Let me quickly go over and tell you what the amendments do. It essentially deletes the entire bill, and we start out all over again.
Yay.
It continues the existence of LUBA, which is supposed to sunset July 1st, 1983, through October 1st, 1983. This was done because July 1st is coming up quickly. All of the other sections of Senate Bill 2295 go into effect October 1st, 1983. We don't, if we leave that 3 month open, if someone wants to file a case, there's no place to file it. You don't can't file over the panel, you can't file with LUBA. And it will take time to set up that administrative panel. And talking to personnel, they said by the time they search for people to fill those positions, they would like to have 3 months. We need to get this over to the Senate, and we used a Senate bill so they could concur on it.
And
Representative Traynor.
If we have neither LUBA nor LURP, these things just automatically happen?
No, they just are in. No, Representative Traynor.
I thought maybe I had an amendment, but it's not going to work. I'll pass on
it's
it.
It's called sitting here in limbo.
Do I have a motion to adopt the
so
Representative Traynor moves that we adopt the amendments to that are proposed before us to Senate Bill 360, dated Senate Bill 360A-2. Any discussion? Clerk, would you call the roll?
Representative Bradbury?
Aye.
Representative Hill?
Aye.
Representative Parkinson? Representative Priestley? Representative Traherne?
Aye.
Representative Troop? Representative Van Leeuwen?
Aye.
Representative Anderson? Chair Hooley?
Aye. Motion passes.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bradbury.
Move Senate Bill 360 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bradbury moves Senate Bill 360 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk, would you call the roll?
Representative Hill?
Aye.
Representative Parkinson? Representative Priestley? Representative Traherne?
Aye.
Representative Troop? Representative Van Leeuwen?
Aye.
Representative Anderson? Representative Bradbury?
Aye.
Chair Hooley?
Aye. Motion passes.
Consent calendar?
Consent calendar. We'll have to get it moved as quickly as possible, and if you could get the committee report in today.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bradbury.
I believe the consent calendar actually slows you down.
Does it?
Has to sit on the consent calendar for a certain
Oh, that's right, it does.
Days.
Okay.
You're right.
Sorry.
We will not put it on the consent calendar, and I'll ask that it be brought up.
Quicker.
I will carry it. Okay. We have, we will now go into hearing and work session on Senate Bill 237. Beth, do we, Carol, do we have a list of those that are wanting to testify today? We have two people here that sat here very patiently through a very hot room Friday. That we're here to answer questions. Chuck Lyles from Department of Agriculture and David Steer from Forestry. Do you want to come up and... Was there someone here also from...
There was, but he's not with us today.
Okay.
Here.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Charles Lyles. I'm the administrator of the Salt and Water Conservation Division, State Department of Agriculture. I have been asked to appear before the committee to try to, I emphasize, to try to answer questions. I will do my best, but I'm making no further commitments, I guess, at this stage.
Mr. Lyles, in, just getting through finding my bill here.
Madam Chair, I might say that the department basically is sympathetic with the aims of the marginal lands bill and does believe that some kind of marginal lands program would be beneficial. We have some concerns, I think, with the current bill, primarily relating to the how it could be administered. But other than that, in general, we support the concept of the marginal lands bill.
Were there any questions on soil classifications for Mr. Lyles? Representative Traynor.
There are, you read the bill. It relates to farm soil classification. And then also on the forest land, it relates to a production of cubic feet per acre, I think is what it's worded. Are there forest land classifications that would be easily recognized across the state?
If I may, Representative Traynor and Madam Chair, I'd defer that question to my colleague.
Yes.
Here.
Madam Chair, Representative Traynor, for the record, Dave Steer, Director of Forest Resources Planning for the Forestry Department. There are some recognizable characteristics. I have some data that I could hand out to you in response to a question I was asked over the phone. Basically, we have the productivity classification is independent of the species that occupies the site. However, as you go from place to place in the state and the conditions vary, soil conditions and climatic conditions, the productivity of the land varies considerably. But there are some similarities between forest types both east and west of the mountains and north and south that I can point out to you.
That'd be a good place to start. Yeah.
Okay.
Would this be the proper time? I'll excuse me. Now the information contained on the handout is derived from statistical sampling of the forest land in the state of Oregon. It is not based on-site, on-the-ground evaluation. So therefore, there are some statistically ascertainable errors in this information. And from time to time, I'll refer to the magnitude of the error that's possible in the figures. On the first page, the cover, the data covers farmer and other private land owners only. It does not cover industrial ownerships nor public ownerships, and is broken out in west side, east side, but it does include the state of Washington, so that we can only draw some inferences here.
Madam Chair.
Representative Traynor.
Before we get into this too deeply, are these the classes you use, 85 plus and 50-85?
That's correct.
What you normally call those?
Yes, that's correct. These are the cubic foot per acre per year productivity classes.
You don't have something then, if I could continue, Madam Chair.
Right.
You don't have something called a site 1, 2, 3, or anything like that?
Representative Trahan, yes, we do. However, in the land use planning goal, they refer specifically to cubic foot site classes, which normally are referred to by the number of cubic feet rather than a 1, 2, 3 designation. The 1-2-3 designation that most foresters are familiar with is separate from this.
Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
I'd like to follow that up. You know, just because it's in goal 4, whatever it is, doesn't mean that it has to be followed, or is that good? When our forestry people and county assessor and everybody else are involved in classes of timberland, I'd like to take a look at that to see whether we can parallel that 85 plus is a certain class of land and 50 to 85 and so on after we get done, I guess.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, there is a conversion that can be performed. It's not mathematical, but there have been tables made up that show the conversion from one classification system to another.
Madam Chair.
Representative Trainer.
I think Representative Anderson is getting to the question that I started out to ask, which wasn't this data, but rather we're looking at on farmland, soil classes. And suddenly with forest land, we start talking about how many cubic feet per acre it'll produce. Now, I honestly do believe that there are several different classifications of forest land that, while they're not exactly the same as farmland classifications, mm-hmm. I don't mean to sound that way, would approximate the same kind of information. And it seems absolutely ridiculous to me to start saying, well, let's talk about farmland class 4 or whatever, mm-hmm. and making a break at some point, and then going to cubic feet per acre on forest land, when in fact we do have forest land classification across the state. Is that not correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Trahan, that is correct. And the SES in their published soil surveys do include woodland suitability classifications. And one can, through the means of that SES soil classification, directly translate agricultural soil types to productivity classes. The problem is they are not directly transferable except through that system.
You're still missing the point. Not trying to transfer agricultural classes mm-hmm. to forest land classes. They can be different. I understand mm-hmm. that. But in fact, there are forest land classes. Is that not correct? Site classes for forest land.
That's correct, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
What I would like to see is what those are and how they relate to one another. I think there are probably three that are fairly commonly accepted, one by the Department of Revenue, one that is used by the small woodlands folks, and I think another that the SES uses, and they may be two of those are the same. And how those would relate so that we could tie some kind of a forest land class to forest land as we have tied farmland classifications to farmland. You see what I'm trying to get at?
Yes, Representative Trahan, I understand what you're getting at. The problem is there's not just one system. That's the problem. And you know, I'm familiar with the ones you mentioned plus others that have been devised by different people, and none of them is universally accepted as correct. So,
one more, Manager.
Representative Trahan.
Is there one that would have a measure across the state that would be used? It may not be universally accepted, but used so that we had a reasonable expectation of that that information being available, whether it be in Southern Oregon or Eastern Oregon or on the coast.
Madam Chair, Representative Trahan, yes, and that's the one I attempted to use, is the cubic foot productivity. It's not very well liked by some people, but it is the information is available throughout the state.
None of the others are?
Not in all of the areas, no, sir. The revenue classification system, for example, is not available for some public lands. But it is, all the public lands are available in the cubic foot site classes, as are now all of the private lands. So it is, and it's independent of the species that grows on the area.
Dave, I have another question to ask you. On page 2 of the bill, line 8 through 11, it talks about located in areas not less than 100 acres composed of predominantly of soils and capability classes 5 through 8 in agricultural capability classification system in use by the United States Department of Agriculture Soil Conservation Service on the effective date of this 83 Act and not capable of producing 85 or more cubic feet of machinable timber per acre. I guess when most of us look at land and talk about marginal land, would you say that would accurately describe marginal land?
I'm
on timber.
Madam Chair, I think that there's a difference here in marginal being a breaking point, so that one needs to know what the range is. And I think that if we look through some of the data that are available, we'll see that what seems to be a reasonable breaking point between highly productive and marginally productive land in one part of the state may not be the same breaking point as it is in other parts of the state. That's been alluded to, I know, by other people that have testified before this committee. And if you'll allow me to, we can go through a little bit here and show you on the data that there, in fact, are some pretty vast differences between east side and west side.
Before we start on that, I have just one more question. It looks to me, and maybe Hector or someone can answer this better, it looks to me on this page that we're looking at two tests for marginal land. One is partialization, and one is what it's capable of producing. I guess I need to explain to me how much parcelization there is in forest land.
Madam Chair, that's something I can't answer. One of the things that in looking at this particular area of the bill, the first thing actually comes on the page before, on line 19 of the first page, where it authorizes local governments to designate agricultural land as marginal. And we are not aware of how much agricultural land in agricultural zoning is actually in forest. We're not aware of that.
If you would, for just one second before you get into that. Hector, can you tell me, is that what you intended on this bill to do, was to have one or the other test for forestry land, for marginal land, the test would either be the parcelization test or the capable of producing test? You need to come up.
If you want me to come up, I can.
Yeah, just.
For the record, I'm Hector McPherson, speaking for Agriculture for Oregon today. And we designed this with the idea that it would be agricultural land. Now, we get into a problem in that you get into the mixed agriculture and forestry lands. But our background and our thinking was really directed toward the agricultural side of this thing. And I can't say that we've answered everything with regard to forestry.
So,
but we did try to protect forestry with the kinds of stipulations that we made for marginal land.
So that on page 2, that 8 through 11, and I'm just trying to get it clear, and I don't know, maybe the rest of the committee members have it clear, but I don't. That on page 2, that section of those lines, 8 through 11, would this really be dealing more with that land that's mixed ag forestry land, so that you're looking at marginal lands only in agricultural lands? Is that correct?
We're thinking of them in terms of everything that's been given an EFU type designation, which is agricultural lands on which some forestry is permitted.
Okay, so this would be only, this it only refers to agricultural land on which many cases it's sort of mixed or which some forestry has been
permitted. We did not try to include the forestry lands that are designated as forestry lands.
Okay, just so that everybody on the committee has it clear.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Hector, why didn't you include forestry land as agriculture?
Representative Anderson, I think it was because we felt it was beyond our expertise. We made a small effort to get together with the small woodlands people. We found that they were going in an entirely different direction than we were. And so we said, well, you work out your problems in the forestry area. We'll see what we can do with the agricultural area. And we realized that there was an overlap between the two, and we tried to take care of it to the extent that we were not allowing good forestry land to be cut up as marginal land by including the kinds of tests in here which would eliminate the best forestry land from marginal land. But we really did not try to make something that would specifically apply to forestry land. Recognizing, I think I said this in the first time I came before this committee, that there is a lot of farm forest area out there which really is not marginal land by our criteria, and we didn't solve the problems for that land. because we felt we really couldn't in terms of what we were trying to do.
I would just, I need to be excused for a few minutes to go testify on another bill. I'll be right back.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
Representative Priestley.
I want to ask the same question. Could you, Andy, or Mr. McPherson explain to me whether or not not having forestry land included makes it so that it's going to be treated more loosely or less loosely for conversion to other uses? What does that mean?
Well, our tests really apply to land, whether it's forestry or whether it's agricultural. And when you apply the tests, whether it's an exclusive farm use or not an exclusive farm use, I think you eliminate the worst problems you've got from the forestry side of this thing. So I think that it really does take forestry into account, but it doesn't really solve all the problems that might be out there.
Solving the problems means what?
Solving the problems, there's a great deal of controversy over whether you should be allowed to build houses on forestry land. And the LCDC, as I understand it, has come up close to actually adopting a forestry rule and really hasn't done it yet. And the amount of parcelization that you're going to allow into straight forestry land, I don't think has really been solved yet. They have allowed, as I understand it, in some of the accepted plans, and I really am speaking something that I don't know that much about, and there are other people in the room that might say it better, have allowed houses to be built on forestry land on rather small parcels under the theory that this land was not being managed well for forestry, that they needed to get better management, and if the person would promise to take the balance besides the 1 acre he built the house on and actually put intensive forestry on the rest of it, that they would allow him to build a house, and this would enhance the forestry goal of providing for the fiber. So they've taken a stand in that direction, but I'm not the best person to explain that to you, Representative Peasley.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, let's return to the chart.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Van Loo.
Had a question while we've got Hector here to help me understand the bill better, and talking about something he and I both are familiar with, and that's Peterson's Butte in Linn County. Under this bill, as it's drawn up here, there are a few people anyway who have acreages of different sizes up on Peterson's Butte who had bought them several years ago with the idea in mind that they would be building sites at some time. I don't know for sure what the class of that soil is. Some of it's not very good soil. Where does that fit in under the marginal lands bill as we have it now?
Representative Van Loo, it's my understanding that almost all the land in western Oregon grows 100 cubic feet or more of timber per acre per year. Now, I'd like to defer that question to the gentleman next door, who can answer that better than I can. If it grows more than 85, the way the bill is drafted today, they could not call it marginal land because it is not marginal as far as forestry is concerned. So it would not be included, unless it's parcelized. If it's parcelized sufficiently to fit the parcelization theory, which I doubt that it is, since from what I know of Peterson View, I don't think you would find 100 acres, although you might, or a bigger area that was parcelized enough to include it. If it is parcelized, regardless of the soil type, it could be included.
Okay, then to continue on with that question, and maybe to the forester beside you, that butte doesn't really grow timber right now. What criteria would you be using to show that it does would grow the 85 cubic feet per year?
May I defer?
Yes, you may.
Representative Van Loo, Dave Steer from the Forestry Department. What the forester uses on the ground is the existing timber or some that is growing in proximity to the area that's intended to be measured. And what he does is find out the age and the height, and from that, through a set of tables, determines the effective productivity of that site. If there is no timber at all growing in the area, then there's no way to determine it, except through soil site analysis.
So where would they fall out in this bill?
Except through soil site analysis. If the SCS has produced a woodland suitability class for that soil, then it's possible to do it on an estimate basis.
Okay, then I'll go back to Hector again. After that discussion, where do those people who have those acreages bought on Peterson's Butte stand with this bill? as written.
I can't even answer what their current zoning is. If it's exclusive farm use, they probably remain in exclusive farm use. If they have taken an exception to that area, which I don't know, then obviously it could go down to rural residential and may not be. As far as Peterson Butte, I would like, I wish the Representative Van Loon that you would inquire about the general area of Western Oregon in relation to site classes and cubic feet, because I think that might help to answer the question a little on what the tops of these knolls that are here in the valley actually produce in cubic feet per acre.
Wait, wait, I didn't understand.
If you simply would ask the gentleman on my right to respond to what, in general, these oak-covered knolls here in the valley, what kind of a site class they tend to fall into as far as cubic feet are concerned, we'd probably get at your question.
Okay, would you answer that question then?
Representative Van Loon, without having gone out on the ground in Peterson Butte myself, the places I have visited in the valley generally fall below 85 cubic feet per acre per year on the rocky knolls and rocky outcroppings on the edges of the valley.
Back to the chart.
Mr. Chair.
Well, Representative Trader.
Going back to the chart. Your headings show west side and east side, and then it says W-O-W-W-A. I assume that's Western Oregon and Western Washington. Is that correct?
That's correct. On this first chart, Representative Trahan, yes.
Do the numbers on the chart then include a combination of both Western and Eastern Oregon and Washington in respective spaces, or are they just Oregon figures?
Representative Trahan, these are combined figures. The forest type breakouts were not available for just Oregon. The other data on the pages following are strictly for Oregon. But what I was trying to illustrate by the, if I may, Representative Anderson, trying to represent by the first chart was that if you know the type of timber that generally grows in that area, then one can draw an inference as to how highly productive that area is. For example, on hemlock in Western Oregon, if that's the predominant species, generally 82% of that will be in Oregon, Western Oregon, Western Washington. 82% of that will be above 85% cubic feet per acre per year. For ponderosa pine, it generally grows on less productive sites, so that it has a different breakdown generally. Now that's all I was trying to portray by that, was just to show that there are some generalizations that can be drawn. On the second page and beyond, then we get specifically to Oregon data. Now, as you notice from the footnote, there will be some numbers that do not add up. Again, this is because it's drawn from sampling data. And also, we need to remind you again that there is a margin of error in these numbers. At the 50,000 acre level, if a number is 50,000, you need to be aware of the fact that number could be larger or smaller. And the number, as a matter of fact, is somewhere between 40,000 and 60,000, with a 68% probability of being correct within that range. So that some of this data is really not very accurate, and I need to present it as such. It's not very accurate data.
Yes, Chair. Representative Hill, what does LPP stand for?
Representative Hill, that's lodgepole pine.
Lodgepole pine.
Oh, okay. I didn't understand about two-thirds of what you just said, okay. So I'm going to ask for the chart, so.
Basically, I guess a legitimate question. We didn't know what LPP was. Could you briefly just go bring Representative Priestley up to speed on the chart where we are?
And then another question. What relates to that is CFL Class 4 land, or what does that stand for?
Representative Anderson, perhaps I better do a little better job of explaining the titles. On the first chart, the front page, besides LPP, we have, reading from the left, Douglas fir, ponderosa pine, hemlock, lodgepole pine, other softwood types, and that includes true fir, other types of pine, and so on, hardwoods, non-stocked acreage, and then, of course, the total.
on the second chart, the title is Area of Commercial Forest Land by Cubic Foot Site Class. Now, this is non-industrial private landowners, which includes farmers and all other private landowners, but does not include any industrial corporations. Now, it does include non-industrial corporations, corporations who do not own and operate a processing plant in the state of Oregon. They may own and operate a processing plant in some other state. So that there are some corporate entities involved here who are actually acting as an industrial owner might. This second chart breaks down the site classification, or breaks down the acreage by site classification by zone of the state. Northwest Oregon includes the counties north of Lincoln and Benton counties, and west of the Willamette River. Northwest Oregon includes those counties north of Marion, Polk, and Lincoln.